Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, join us for a Radio Lillooet special presentation of the exploits and triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, Chess Champion. A book by Frederick Milnes Edge in 5 parts.
Section 8 of The Exploits and Triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, the Chess Champion. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Marian Spiegel. The Exploits and Triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, the Chess Champion, by Frederick Milne Edge. Chapter 6, The Staunton Affair, Part 1. We must anticipate the events of a few months in order to place the discussion with Mr. Staunton where it properly belongs, viz., with Morphy's achievements in England. I do not think I have omitted a single fact or incident connected with an affair which has now become history, and my readers will agree with me that Mr. Staunton has suffered a far worse defeat by not playing the match than if he had been vanquished, as everybody says he would have been. In dealing with this most delicate question, I feel desirous of letting facts, as far as possible, speak for themselves. But as it is the province and the duty of historians to seek the causes of events, and to criticize the actions of their dramatis personae, I shall record, in all honesty and kindliness, what I believe to have been the motives at work in this contest. And in order that nothing may remain unsaid, I shall give all the correspondence on the subject, both pro and con. Paul Morphy's principal object in coming to Europe was to play a match with Mr. Staunton. I am well aware that a young gentleman travelling for the first time in foreign countries must have many objects in view, but in this particular case, the pretext for the voyage, the very inducement for his friends to consent to his journey, was to repeat the challenge personally, in England, which Mr. Staunton had declined, on the ground of the place of combat not being in Europe. It is necessary that this point should be understood, because much of the controversy hinges upon it. If we examine the challenge addressed to Mr. Staunton by the New Orleans Chess Club, we find therein two main ideas. Firstly, that Mr. Staunton is a representative of European chess. Secondly, that American players challenge him to combat with their representative. Mr. Staunton's reply raised but one objection, and that objection led Paul Morphy across the Atlantic, in order to remove the only stumbling block in the way of the contest. I was constantly with Morphy after his arrival in London, and a frequent subject of conversation between us was the match with Mr. Staunton. That, too, was the first, the principal topic at all the London clubs we visited, and everything but the date was looked upon as decided. Mr. Staunton, however, had not, as yet, stated explicitly that he accepted the challenge, but he did so, viva voce, shortly after Mr. Morphy's arrival, and subsequently in the Illustrated London News. It seems as if Mr. Staunton had refrained from accepting the de fi until a somewhat accurate estimate could be formed of his challenger's strength. Previously to the latter's arrival, Mr. S.'s opinion of him was not at all equal to that entertained by his countrymen in America, nor did any player in England give him the rank which he now holds. There were no means by which to judge of his force. Not a dozen of his games, all told, had been seen in Europe, and his antagonists were comparatively unknown, with the exception of Mr. Charles H. Stanley. But that gentleman had, for some years, withdrawn from the chess arena, and his play with Morphy did not, certainly, equal his former exploits with Rousseau and Schulten. It was, therefore, absolutely necessary to await the result of his play with some known European antagonist, and I feel confident that the stature of his ability was measured on his first 12 or 15 games with Mr. Barnes. Judging from these parties, Paul Morphy was little, if anything, superior to that gentleman, but the time had not been allowed for him to recover from the fatigues of his voyage, and I have always remarked that travelling, even by rail, seriously deteriorates Morphy's game. In accepting the challenge, Mr. Staunton postponed the commencement of the match for a month, in order to brush up his openings and endings. This was too reasonable for Morphy to decline. Subsequently, As will be seen by the latter's correspondence, Mr. Staunton obtained a postponement until after the Birmingham meeting in August. In the meantime, the young American had won the match with Herr Löwenthal, beaten Alter in a set contest at pawn and move, and startled the chess community by the imposing manner in which he had triumphed over every opponent. Public opinion had changed in respect to him. This was evinced by the way in which the London players, almost universally, spoke of the proposed match. I have heard gentlemen at the London Chess Club, the Divan, nay, even at the St. George's, declare repeatedly, "Mr. Staunton now knows too well what antagonist he will have to deal with. Depend upon it, he will find means of backing out." This language, repeated at every turn, necessarily caused Paul Morphy some anxiety. On myself, however, I can conscientiously declare it had no effect. I did not believe it possible that any man having so publicly accepted a challenge would attempt to avoid a contest, and express this opinion to Mr. Morphy. "It will be well not to accept all that one hears. Mr. Staunton has numerous enemies. Do not allow yourself to be prejudiced by them, but look upon his acceptance of the challenge as a certainty that the match will come off." With yet unshaken confidence in Mr. Staunton's intention to play, Paul Morphy addressed him a short note, 10 days prior to the Birmingham meeting. To this he received a somewhat lengthy reply, the main point in it being that Mr. Staunton still required a few weeks for preparation. Morphy responded forthwith, entirely removing all ground for further excuse by leaving the terms to himself. Here was an unjustifiable mode of putting an end to diplomacy. Mr. S. could not continue a correspondence with one so overwhelmingly courteous, and he left London for Birmingham, without even acknowledging the receipt of the letter. Much argument has been built up against Paul Morphy on his non-appearance in the tournament, and one writer has endeavored to prove from it that he was afraid to meet Mr. Staunton. Before leaving London, the latter gentleman assured his young opponent that he should not enter the lists, but should confine himself to simple consultation games. Why Mr. S. changed his mind, it is not for me to say, although I might argue that Mr. Staunton sallied forth courageously when he was certain that Achilles keeps his tent. However, Paul Morphy's first reason for not entering the tourney was that, his main object being to meet Mr. Staunton, and that gentleman having stated his intention of confining himself to a mere consultation game, as in past years, there was no chance of their crossing swords, and, consequently, no use of his spending 2 or 3 weeks in a contest which could never be a decisive test of skill. But, when repeated telegrams assured him that the English champion had decided on becoming a contestant, there were still stronger reasons for his continued declination. These reasons were the consequences of Mr. Staunton's own acts, added to the opinion of nearly every London player, that the gentleman was seeking an opportunity to evade the match. All these occurrences had somewhat shaken Mr. Morphy's faith, and he could not but be suspicious of his antagonist's movements. He therefore declined positively and finally to enter the tournament, under the belief that, whether he won or lost in that contest, it would be equally to the prejudice of the challenge. Mr. Staunton might say, "I have beaten Morphy, what's the use of further contest?" Or, "He has beaten me, I'm consequently out of play, it would be madness to attempt a set match." This, and this only, prevented Paul Morphy from visiting Birmingham at the commencement of the tournament. Had he gone there when requested, every influence would have been brought to bear to induce him to alter his determination, and he merely consulted the interests of the contest he had so much at heart, by keeping out of temptation until the tournament was too far under way to admit of his entering it. But the meeting of the association afforded an admirable opportunity to obtain from Mr. Staunton the naming of the day on which the match should commence. Part of the proceedings of the anniversary was a public soirée, and Paul Morphy resolved that he would then ask his antagonist, in the face of all present, to fix the date. I had the pleasure of accompanying our hero to Birmingham, and I witnessed the disagreeable contretemps which upset this admirable intention. Crossing the courtyard of the college on the morning of the soirée, we met Lord Lyttelton, Mr. Staunton, Mr. Avery, and, I think, Mr. Wills. Now I do not know whether Mr. Staunton had got wind of what was to occur, but his action certainly frustrated Morphy's plan, and, for the moment, gave him the advantage. In all such rencontres, the man who gets the first word has the attack, and Mr. Staunton instantly availed himself of it. He opened fire by declaring that he was entirely out of play, that he had long been engaged on a great work, that he was under bonds to his publishers accordingly, that he might subject them to a loss of many thousands in playing at the present time, and so forth. But he never stated aught that appeared to intimate the possibility of the match not coming off eventually, his plea being that he required further time, in order to put sufficient matter into the hands of the printers, and to prepare himself subsequently for the contest. It was now Morphy's turn, and the attack changed hands. The question was put, "Mr. Staunton, will you play in October, in November, or December? Choose your own time, but let the arrangement be final." The answer was, "Well, Mr. Morphy, if you will consent to the postponement, I will play you at the beginning of November. I will see my publishers and let you know the exact date within a few days." The association now looked upon the affair as decided, and Morphy left Birmingham, firmly believing that the match would come off after all. On the 28th of August, within a few days of the above conversation, the following extraordinary announcement appeared in the Illustrated London News. A specimen of Mr. Staunton's style of play. Antibook. As you surmise, knowing the authority, the slang of the sporting paper in question regarding the proposed encounter between Mr. Staunton and the young American is bunkum. In matches of importance it is the invariable practice in this country, before anything definite is settled, for each party to be provided with representatives to arrange the terms and money for the stakes. Mr. Morphy has come here unfurnished in both respects, and, although both will no doubt be forthcoming in due time, it is clearly impossible, until they are, that any determinate arrangement can be made. 2. The statement of another contemporary that the reduction in the amount of stakes from £1,000 aside to £500 was made at the suggestion of the English amateur is equally devoid of truth, the proposal to reduce the amount having been made by Mr. Morphy. I was perfectly astonished when I read this statement. Mr. Morphy had caused the stakes to be reduced from £1,000 to £500 aside. Without mentioning Englishmen, there were Americans in London and Paris who asserted that Morphy could be backed against Mr. Staunton for £10,000 and the money be raised within 24 hours. I mentioned this fact to a noble lady in Paris in order to show the confidence in which the young American was held, and she replied, "Oh, as regards that, you may tell Mr. Morphy from me that for £10,000 against Mr. Staunton, or any player in Europe, he must not go further than my house." I asked Morphy to demand an immediate retraction of the unblushing statements contained in the above paragraph, but he replied, "When a man resorts to such means as these, he will not stop until he has committed himself irredeemably. Let him go on." Shortly after that, Mr. Staunton changed his tactics. Let not the reader suppose I am about to represent things otherwise than they appear on the record. Let him first take up the files of the Illustrated London News, from the time of Morphy's arrival in England to his match with Harwitz. Let him examine the analysis of the games, the notes of the moves in that paper, and he will invariably perceive that the American's antagonists could, or might have, won, the necessary inference being, there's nothing so extraordinary about Morphy's play, after all. A change appeared in the criticism on the 8 blindfold games at Birmingham, but, then, Morphy stood alone, and interfered with no one's pretensions. When, however, the match with Harwitz came off, Mr. Staunton's tone was suddenly altered, and this gentleman, who previously had scarcely a word of commendation for Morphy, now talked of combinations which would have excited the admiration of Labourdonius. The force of language could no further go. Mr. Morphy judged from this unexpected change of tone that Mr. Staunton either believed that these contests with continental players would take up so much of his time in Europe that he would have to leave without playing him, or that Mr. S. was experimenting on the maxim, "There are more flies caught with honey than with vinegar." He therefore addressed him the following letter, and in order that the public might no longer be under misapprehension as to the case in hand, he sent copies of the communication to those papers which had shown him marked kindness in Europe. At the suggestion of a very shrewd and attached American friend, a copy was also forwarded to the editor-in-chief of the Illustrated London News. The publication of the letter to Mr. Staunton in so many journals was a judicious proceeding. Newspapers are not fond of embarking in a discussion which may, probably, draw its slow length along and terminate angrily. Besides, Whatever the feeling might be on the merits of the case, Mr. Staunton was certainly in the position of English champion, and John Bull does not like it to be proclaimed that one of his sons shows the white feather. But, at the same time, rivalry exists between all journals as to precedence of news, and one paper will not willingly be behind the others in giving Morphy's letter. Accordingly, the following Saturday, Bell's Life, The Era, The Field, and The Sunday Times published it as follows. Morphy's letter to Staunton. Café de la Régence, Paris, October 6th, 58. Howard Staunton, Esquire. Sir, on my arrival in England 3 months since, I renewed the challenge to you personally which the New Orleans Chess Club had given some months previously. You immediately accepted, but demanded a month's delay in order to prepare yourself for the contest. Subsequently, you proposed that the time should be postponed until after the Birmingham meeting, to which I assented. On the approach of the period you had fixed, I addressed you a communication requesting that the necessary preliminaries might be immediately settled, but you left London without replying to it. I went to Birmingham for the express purpose of asking you to put a stop to further delay by fixing a date for the opening of our match, but before the opportunity presented itself, you came to me, and, in the presence of Lord Littleton, Mr. Avery, and other gentlemen, you stated that your time was much occupied in editing a new edition of Shakespeare, and that you were under heavy bonds to your publishers accordingly. But you reiterated your intention to play me, and said that if I would consent to a further postponement until the first week in November, you would, within a few days, communicate with me and fix the exact date. I have heard nothing further from you, either privately, by letter, or through the columns of the Illustrated London News. A statement appeared in the chess department of that journal a few weeks since that Mr. Morphy had come to Europe unprovided with backers or seconds, the inference being obvious that my want of funds was the reason of our match not taking place. As you are the editor of that department of the Illustrated London News, I felt hurt that a gentleman who had always received me at his club and elsewhere with great kindness and courtesy should allow so prejudicial a statement to be made in reference to me, one, too, which is not strictly in accordance with fact. Permit me to repeat what I have invariably declared in every chess community I have had the honor of entering, that I am not a professional player, that I have never wished to make any skill I possess the means of pecuniary advancement, and that my earnest desire is never to play for any stake but honor. My friends in New Orleans, however, subscribed a certain sum, without any countenance from me, and that sum has been ready for you to meet a considerable time past. Since my arrival in Paris, I have been assured by numerous gentlemen that the value of those stakes can be immediately increased to any amount, but for myself personally, reputation is the only incentive I recognize. The matter of seconds cannot, certainly, offer any difficulty. I had the pleasure of being first received in London by the St. George's Chess Club, of which you are so distinguished a member, and of those gentlemen I request the honor of appointing my seconds, to whom I give full authority in settling all preliminaries. In conclusion, I beg leave to state that I have addressed a copy of this letter to the editors of the Illustrated London News, Bell's Life in London, The Era, The Field, and The Sunday Times, being desirous that our true position should no longer be misunderstood by the community at large. Again requesting you to fix the date for our commencing the match, I have the honor to remain, sir, your very humble servant, Paul Morphy. At the same time, Mr. Morphy forwarded the following communication to the secretary of the St. George's, requesting the club to appoint his seconds in the match. Morphy's letter to the St. George's Club. T. Hampton, Esquire, Secretary of the St. George's Chess Club. Sir, I beg respectfully to inform you that the New Orleans Chess Club has deposited £500 at the banking house of Messrs. Haywood & Co., London, that sum being my proportion of the stakes in the approaching match with Mr. Staunton. I shall esteem it a great honor if the St. George's Chess Club will do me the favor of appointing my seconds in that contest. To such gentlemen as they may appoint, I leave the settling of all preliminaries. May I request you to lay this communication before the members of the club, and to oblige me with an early answer. I have the honor to remain, sir, your very humble and obedient servant, Paul Morphy. Café de la Régence, Paris, October 8, 1858. It would be difficult to imagine a more respectful and kindly letter than that to Mr. Staunton. Since Morphy's arrival in Europe, he had considered himself ill-used by that gentleman. His games had been annotated in an inferentially depreciatory manner, his victories accounted for, and his antagonists excused. He had been placed in a ridiculous light before the public by the utterly false assertion that he had come to Europe to challenge Mr. Staunton or anyone else without a groat in his purse, and yet he never charges Mr. Staunton with being the author of the falsehood, although Mr. S. is the known editor of the chess column of the Illustrated London News. He positively invites explanation in the most charitable and Christian-like manner, never even calling his statement in question, as he might have done, a positive untruth, but politely characterizing it as not strictly in accordance with fact. End of section 8. The Exploits and Triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, the Chess Champion, by Frederick Milne Edge. Chapter 6. The Staunton Affair, Part 2. The Illustrated London News did not immediately publish the letter, or make any remark upon it, as did the other papers, but at the commencement of the week, Paul Morphy received a private communication from Mr. Staunton as follows. Staunton's reply to Morphy. London, October 9th, 1858. Sir, in reply to your letter, I have to observe that you must be perfectly conscious that the difficulty in the way of my engaging in a chess match is one over which I have no control. You were distinctly apprised, in answer to the extraordinary proposal of your friends, that I should leave my home, family, and avocations, to proceed to New Orleans for the purpose of playing chess with you, that a long and arduous contest, even in London, would be an undertaking too formidable for me to embark in without ample opportunity for the recovery of my old strength in play, together with such arrangements as would prevent the sacrifice of my professional engagements. Upon your unexpected arrival here, the same thing was repeated to you, and my acceptance of your challenge was entirely conditional on my being able to gain time for practice. The experience, however, of some weeks, during which I have labored unceasingly to the serious injury of my health, shows that not only is it impracticable for me to save time for that purpose, but that by no means short of giving up a great work on which I am engaged, subjecting the publishers to the loss of thousands, and myself to an action for breach of contract, could I obtain time even for the match itself. Such a sacrifice is, of course, out of all question. A match at chess, or cricket, pro pudor, why doesn't he say, or skittles, may be a good thing in its way, but none but a madman would, for either, forfeit his engagements and imperil his professional reputation. Under these circumstances, I waited only the termination of your late struggle, with Mr. Harwitz, to explain that, fettered as I am at this moment, it is impossible for me to undertake any enterprise which would have the effect of withdrawing me from duties I am pledged to fulfill. The result is not, perhaps, what either you or I desired, as it will occasion disappointment to many, but it is unavoidable, and the less to be regretted, since a contest, wherein one of the combatants must fight under disadvantages so manifest as those I should have to contend against, after many years' retirement from practical chess, with all my attention absorbed and my brain overtaxed by more important pursuits, could never be accounted a fair trial of skill. I have the honor to be, yours, etc., H. Staunton. Paul Morphy, Esquire. P.S. I may add that, although denied the satisfaction of a set encounter with you at this period, I shall have much pleasure, if you will again become my guest, in playing with you a few games sans façon. Now, the sending of this private communication was a strange course for Mr. Staunton to adopt. It seemed to be a bait for Morphy, in order that Mr. S. might use his reply in the forthcoming article in the Illustrated London News. The young American resolved that all the correspondence should be public and above board, and did not even acknowledge the receipt of the letter. The Saturday following, Mr. Staunton gave as an excuse for not publishing Morphy's missive the length of M.'s games, but promised it and his own response next week. On Saturday, the 24th of October, the two following effusions graced the columns of Bell's Life. They had also been sent to The Era, The Field, and The Sunday Times, but, being anonymous, and enclosing no name or address, were refused admittance. Anonymous letter, apparently from Mr. Staunton. Trinity College, Cambridge, October 9. Mr. Editor, if you entered any chess circle just now, the questions sure to be asked are, how about the Staunton and Morphy match? Will it come off? Suspect Staunton wants to shirk it. Now to these questions it is not always easy to give an answer, and yet they ought to be answered, so as to allow of no possible misconstruction amongst either friends or foes. There is one insinuation which may be very briefly disposed of, namely, that Mr. Staunton wishes to avoid playing. Everyone who knows him is perfectly aware that he is only too ready to play at all times, and that at every disadvantage, rather than incur even the faintest suspicion of showing the white feather. For the benefit of those who have not the pleasure of knowing him, or whose memories are not over tenacious, I may cite as an example that in 1844, after vanquishing Saint Amant, upon a hint in the French papers that his opponent had expressed a wish to have his revenge, Mr. S. at once started for Paris once more, and challenged him to the field. That from 1840 to 1848, Mr. S. played with every antagonist, foreign and English, that could be brought against him. And at the Chess Congress, in 1851, he rose superior to all personal considerations, and did not shrink from risking his hardly earned reputation, when the state of his health was such that he felt he could not do himself justice, and all this solely that the tournament might not want the éclat which his presence could confer upon it. But, sir, I would submit that this is not simply a question between Mr. Staunton and Mr. Morphy. We are all interested in it. Mr. Staunton is the representative of English chess, and must not be allowed to risk the national honor in an unequal contest, to gratify either the promptings of his own chivalrous disposition or the vanity of an antagonist. Oh, then you admit that Morphy is the better player? No such thing. The question is, not as to which is the better player, but whether, if they meet now, they can do so on equal terms. Now, I call it an unequal contest when one player, in tip-top practice, with nothing to distract his attention, engages another who is quite out of play, and whose mind is harassed by the unceasing pressure of other and more important avocations. This is precisely Mr. Staunton's case. He is engaged, in addition to his customary occupations, upon a literary work of great responsibility and magnitude, which leaves him scarcely a moment for any other pursuit, certainly not for chess practice. Indeed, were it merely a question of time, it would be almost impossible for Mr. Staunton to play a match at the present moment. But this is a matter of small importance compared with the mental strain which accompanies such incessant labor. There is nothing which requires more concentration of thought than chess. One moment of relaxed attention, and the fruits of the most profound combination are scattered to the winds. Real chess between two great players is no mere recreation, but a severe study, and should never be attempted when there is anything else to claim the least share of that attention which alone can ensure success. If Mr. Staunton can steal a few months from business, and devote himself wholly to chess, by all means let him do so, and then meet Mr. Morphy when and where he pleases, and I for one should have no fear of the result. If he cannot do this, I trust he will have moral courage to say no. If not, his friend should say it for him. He is, at least, pawn and two, below his force of 10 years back, and I repeat that he owes it to the English chess world, whose representative he is, not to meet Mr. Morphy at such odds, when he has everything to lose and nothing to gain. In the present instance, moreover, he is not under the slightest obligation to play, as Mr. Morphy gave him no intimation that he was coming over at this particular time, and I believe Mr. Staunton was not aware of his intention of so doing till he was actually en route. And it is certainly rather a heavy price to pay for the position which Mr. Staunton justly occupies, if he is to be held bound to enter the lists with every young adventurer who has nothing else to do, and who happens to envy him the laurels so fairly won in many hundreds of encounters with nearly all the greatest players of the day. The result of any match which he might now play with Mr. Morphy would prove literally nothing as to their relative chess powers, and I am very unwilling to believe that the American would at all value a victory snatched under such circumstances. Yours obediently, M. A. P.S. Since writing the above, my attention has been drawn to a letter in Bell's Life addressed to Mr. Staunton by Mr. Morphy, in which the latter tries to assume the character of a much injured and ill-used man. Now, how stands the case? From the time when he made his sudden appearance here to the present moment, Mr. Morphy has been fully aware that the delay in the proposed contest did not depend upon Mr. Staunton, who, so far as he is personally concerned, was, and is, prepared to play, though it does not speak much for that man's sense of honor who would ever think of forcing on a contest when the inequality is so immense as it is between Mr. Morphy's position and that of Mr. Staunton. The one with literally nothing to do but go where he lists to play chess, the other with scarcely time for sleep and meals, with his brain in a constant whirl with the strain upon it. The one in the very zenith of his skill, after 10 years of incessant practice, the other utterly out of practice for that very period. Now, let any one read the reply of Mr. Staunton to the preposterous proposal on the part of Mr. Morphy's friends, that he, Mr. S., should go over to New Orleans, and then say whether Mr. Morphy, after publicly announcing in the American papers his inability, from family engagements, to visit England before 1859, and then choosing to come over without a moment's warning, has anybody but himself to blame if he finds there is considerable difficulty in inducing a man with family cares and immersed in professional engagements to sacrifice all for the sake of engaging, upon the most unfair and unequal terms, in a match at chess? If Mr. Morphy does not see the force of what I have advanced, perhaps the following analogous case may bring conviction home to him. Let us suppose some 10 or 15 years have elapsed, and that Mr. Morphy, no longer a chess knight-errant, eager to do battle against all comers, has settled down into a steady-going professional man. The bar, I believe, is his destination, and with bewildered brain is endeavoring to unravel the intricacies of some half-dozen lawsuits put into his hands by clients, each of whom, in virtue of his fee, is profoundly impressed with the belief that Mr. Morphy belongs, body and soul, to him. Presently comes a rap at the door, and in walks a young man, fresh from school or college, and at once proceeds to explain the object of his visit, with, "Mr. Morphy, I come to challenge you to a match at chess. I am aware that you are quite out of practice while I am in full swing. I freely admit that you may have forgotten more than I am ever likely to know, that you have a reputation to lose, while I have one to gain, that you have not a moment you can call your own, whilst I have now nothing in the world to occupy my attention but chess. Ne importe. Every dog has his day. I expect you to play me at all costs. My seconds will wait upon you at once, and if you decline I shall placard you a craven through the length and breadth of the Union." How would Mr. Morphy reply to such a challenge? Very much, I suspect, as Mr. Staunton now replies to his. "I have no apprehension of your skill. I am quite willing to meet you when I can, but I must choose my own time. I cannot put aside my professional engagements, to say nothing of the loss of emolument entailed by such a course, and risk my reputation as a chess player at a moment's notice just to gratify your ambition." In giving such an answer, Mr. Morphy would do perfectly right, and this is precisely the answer which Mr. Staunton now gives to him. And why Mr. Morphy should feel himself aggrieved I cannot possibly imagine. There is one other point which I think deserves mention, namely that 4 years ago, on the occasion of his being challenged in a similar manner, Mr. Staunton put forth a final proposal to play any player in the world, and to pay his expenses for coming to England. This défi remained open for 6 months, and he announced that if not taken up in that time he should hold himself exonerated in refusing any future challenges. I now leave the question in the hands of the public, who will, I doubt not, arrive at a correct appreciation of its merits. Another very disgraceful anonymous letter. To the editor of Bell's Life. Mr. Editor, it is a pity chess players will not wash their dirty linen at home. Among a few frivolous noodles to whom chess forms the staple of life, Mr. Morphy's jeremiads may assume an air of importance, but to sensible men they sound ineffably absurd, while to those who take the trouble of looking a little below the surface they appear something worse. For what are the plain facts of the case? Mr. Morphy started for England, not to play a match with Mr. Staunton, for he was told that that gentleman was too deeply immersed in business to undertake one, but to take part in a general tourney to be held in Birmingham. Upon arriving here, he duly inscribed his name on the list of combatants, and paid his entrance fee. On hearing this, Mr. Staunton, in a spirit of what some may call chivalry, but which, looking at his utterly unprepared state for an encounter of this kind, ought more properly to be termed quixotism, entered his name also. Well, what happened? On the mustering of the belligerents, Mr. Morphy, who had come 6,000 miles to run a tilt in this tournament, was not present. In his place came a note to say particular business prevented his attendance. A message was dispatched, intimating that his absence would be a great disappointment, etc., etc. His reply was that, understanding neither Mr. S. nor any of the other leading players would take the field, he declined to do so. A second message was forwarded, to the effect that Mr. Staunton was then in Birmingham expressly to meet Mr. Morphy, and that he and several of the best players were awaiting Mr. M.'s arrival to begin the combats. To this came a final answer, to the effect that the length of time that the tourney would last prevented Mr. Morphy from joining in it, but he would run down in 2 or 3 days. Passing over the exquisite taste of this proceeding, and the disappointment and murmurs it occasioned, I would simply ask, if Mr. Morphy thought himself justified in withdrawing from a contest which he had come thousands of miles to take part in, and to which he was in a manner pledged, upon pretenses so vague and flimsy, what right has he to complain if the English player chose to withdraw from one to which he is in no respect bound, and against which he may be enabled to offer the most solid and unanswerable objections? In asking this, I beg to disclaim all intention of provoking a chess player's controversy, a thing in which the public take not the slightest interest, and for which I individually entertain supreme contempt. I am moved to it only by the spirit of fair play. Birmingham. To these communications the editor appended the following remarks. We print the above 2 letters, being all the communications we have received from Mr. Staunton's party relative to Morphy's letter in our last. We regret these loose abrasions are anonymous, as not showing how far they really represent the opinions of Mr. Staunton himself and his friends on the subject. Regarding their style and phraseology, Mr. Staunton may perhaps ask to be saved from his friends, but that is a matter of taste. We shall feel bound to print brief replies from Paul Morphy's side. Inferiority once admitted, no matter from what cause, if Mr. Staunton takes the ground indicated in the above epistles, Mr. Morphy has but cheerfully and quietly to drop the subject, and will certainly, as a gentleman, never challenge Mr. Staunton again. Morphy's friends may still reasonably inquire why all this was not said in June last, instead of giving apparent acceptance to the young American's challenge. Editor Bell's Life. The reader will observe that Mr. Staunton, or his friends, is the first to commence a newspaper war, probably under the impression that lengthy protocoling would sink the real question at issue, or induce Paul Morphy to reply and commit himself. But the latter saw too clearly what eventualities might arise, and resolved that, in spite of all attacks, he would never be drawn into discussion. In his letter to Mr. Staunton, no point was raised on which to build dispute. Mr. S. was merely required to say what date he fixed for the match. The most sensitive mind could not be hurt with anything in the letter, and yet, fair play, talks of Mr. Morphy's jeremiads appearing something worse than ineffably absurd. M.A.'s lucubration did not obtain admittance into any other paper, but fair play's shone resplendently in the columns of the Illustrated London News. I have not learned who fair play is, nor do I wish to know. When a man's course is straightforward and courageous, he will always find defenders, and sometimes ardent partisans. Morphy's unassuming modesty had made him friends in every chess community, men who were ready to battle for him as though it were their own quarrel. Hitherto not a word had been said by, or for, Morphy in the press, and he was determined not to seek succor from that source. The ensuing Saturday the following letters appeared in Bell's Life, the first being from a friend of our hero, well acquainted with the circumstances of the case, and the others from prominent members of the metropolitan chess circles. A letter from a friend of Paul Morphy. To the editor of Bell's Life in London. Sir, 2 letters appeared in your paper of last Sunday, one with the signature M.A., the other of Fair Play. In justice to fact, those communications must not remain unanswered, as the misstatements they contain might perchance mislead some as to the good faith of Mr. Morphy. It is in no improper spirit that I appear before your readers under my own name, but simply because, as I intend replying to your anonymous correspondence with facts, not with hypotheses, I think I am bound in honor to hold myself responsible for what I advance. The chess players of London and Birmingham are not ignorant of the intimacy with which Mr. Morphy has honored me during his visit to Europe, and they will permit me to state that no one is better conversant with the facts bearing on the case in point than your subscriber. Were it not that Paul Morphy positively refuses to reply to any attack upon himself, preferring that his actions should be the sole witness to his faith, I should not have troubled you or the public with this communication. On the 4th of last February, the New Orleans Chess Club challenged Mr. Staunton to visit the Crescent City to meet Mr. Paul Morphy in a chess match. On the 3rd of April, the former gentleman replied to this défi in the Illustrated London News in the following language. The terms of this cartel are distinguished by extreme courtesy and, with one notable exception, by extreme liberality also. The exception in question, however, we refer to the clause which stipulates that the combat shall take place in New Orleans, appears to us utterly fatal to the match, and we must confess our astonishment that the intelligent gentlemen who drew up the conditions did not themselves discover this. Could it possibly escape their penetration that if Mr. Paul Morphy, a young gentleman without family ties or professional claims upon his attention, finds it inconvenient to anticipate by a few months an intended visit to Europe, his proposed antagonist, who is well known for years to have been compelled, by laborious literary occupation, to abandon the practice of chess beyond the indulgence of an occasional game, must find it not merely inconvenient, but positively impracticable, to cast aside all engagements and undertake a journey of many thousand miles for the sake of a chess encounter. Surely the idea of such a sacrifice is not admissible for a single moment. If Mr. Morphy, for whose skill we entertain the liveliest admiration, be desirous to win his spurs among the chess chivalry of Europe, he must take advantage of his proposed visit next year. He will then meet in this country, in France, in Germany, and in Russia, many champions whose names must be as household words to him, ready to test and do honor to his prowess. No one would regard the above observations as tantamount to aught else than, if you will come to Europe, I will play you. But we are relieved from the difficulty of discovering Mr. Staunton's real meaning by his reiterated declarations that he would play Mr. Morphy. Within a few days of the latter's arrival in London, the English player stated his intention of accepting the match, but postponed the commencement of it for a month, on the plea of requiring preparation. In the month of July, the acceptance of the challenge was announced in the Illustrated London News. Before the expiration of the time demanded in the first instance, Mr. Staunton requested that the contest should not take place until after the Birmingham meeting. At Birmingham, he again declared his intention of playing the match, and fixed the date for the first week in November, in the presence of numerous witnesses. Mr. Morphy may have erred in believing that his antagonist intended to act as his words led him to suppose, but it was an error shared in common by every one then present, and particularly by Lord Lyttelton, the president of the British Chess Association, who recognized the true position of the case in his speech to the association, stating that he wished him, Mr. Morphy, most cordially success in his encounters with the celebrated players of Europe, whom he had gallantly left home to meet. He should be pleased to hear that he vanquished all, except one, but that one, Mr. Staunton, he must forgive him, as an Englishman, for saying he hoped he would conquer him. Report of Birmingham Meeting, Illustrated London News, September 18, 1858. So firmly convinced were the members of Mr. S.'s own club, the St. George's, that he had accepted the challenge, that a committee was formed and funds raised to back him. What those gentlemen must now think of Mr. Staunton's evasion of the match can easily be understood, but so strong was the conviction in other chess circles that he would not play that large odds were offered to that effect. M.A.'s reasons for not playing, or M.A.'s reasons for Mr. Staunton's not playing, a distinction without a difference, as we shall hereafter show, is that he is engaged upon a literary work of great responsibility and magnitude. Did not this reason exist prior to Mr. Morphy's arrival in June? And if so, why were Mr. Morphy, the English public, and the chess community generally, led into the belief that the challenge was accepted. And what did Mr. Staunton mean by stating at Birmingham, in the presence of Lord Lyttelton, Mr. Avery, and myself, that if the delay until November were granted him, he could in the meanwhile supply his publishers with sufficient matter so as to devote himself subsequently to the match? Mr. Staunton's, I mean M.A.'s, remark in the letter under review, I, Staunton, or M.A., indifferently, have no apprehension of your skill, is hardly consonant with the previous observation that he, Staunton, is at least pawn and two below his force, unless the English chess world representative wishes it to be understood that he could offer those odds to Paul Morphy. Nor is it consonant with the fact that he has never consented to play Mr. Morphy a single game, though asked to do so, and when frequently meeting him at St. George's. Of course, the two consultation games played by him, in alliance with Alter, against Messrs. Barnes and Morphy count for nothing, as they were gained by the latter, a result due, doubtless, to Alter alone. Mr. Morphy, in the eyes of the chess world, can have nothing to gain from a contest with this gentleman. When Mr. Staunton has met even players such as Anderson, Heiderbrandt, and Lowenthal, he has succumbed, whilst his youthful antagonist can cite a roll of victories unparalleled since Labourdonnais. And here is the true reason for M.A.'s saying, Staunton must not be allowed to risk the national honour, in an unequal contest. In wishing M.A. adieu, I would state that his style of composition is so like Mr. Staunton's that no one could detect the difference. And no one but Mr. Staunton himself would ever set up such a defense as M.A.'s, that of inferiority, pawn and two below his strength, etc., etc. And no one but Mr. Staunton could have such intimate knowledge of his own thoughts as we find in the following verbatim quotations from M.A.'s letter. The state of his health was such that he felt he could not do himself justice. His mind harassed. The other, Staunton, with scarcely time for sleep and meals, with his brain in a constant whirl with the strain upon it. In the language of the Holy Writ, no man can know the spirit of man, but the spirit of man which is in him. Served up in a mass of foul language, the letter signed Fair Play contains an obvious untrue assertion, namely, Mr. Morphy started for Europe not to play a match with Mr. Staunton. This is rather outrageous in the face of the challenge from the New Orleans Chess Club, and with Mr. S.'s reply in the Illustrated London News of April 3rd. So much was it Mr. Morphy's desire to play him, and so little his intention to engage in the Birmingham tournament, that he informed the secretary he did not regard such a contest as any true test of skill. To sum up the whole matter, I will state the naked facts. 1. Mr. Morphy came to Europe to play Mr. Staunton. 2. Mr. Staunton made everybody believe he had accepted the challenge from Mr. Morphy. 3. Mr. Staunton allowed the St. George's Chess Club to raise money to back him. 4. Mr. Staunton asked for a delay of 1 month in order to brush up his openings and endings. 5. Mr. Staunton requested a postponement until after the Birmingham meeting. 6. Mr. Staunton fixed the beginning of November for the commencement of the match. If all this does not mean, I will play, then there is no meaning in language. I beg to subscribe myself, Mr. Editor, most respectfully yours, Frederick Milnes Edge, Hotel Breteuil, Paris, October 20th, 1858. End of Section 9. The Exploits and Triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, the Chess Champion, by Frederick Milnes Edge. Chapter 6. The Staunton Affair, Part 3. The next epistle is from the pen of a former colleague of Mr. Staunton, a gentleman whose literary articles in the Chess Player's Chronicle have earned worldwide notoriety. In the case under examination, he dissects Mr. Staunton's procedures with the skill of an able anatomist. Letter from a coadjutor of Mr. Staunton to the editor of Bell's Life. Sir, in the few remarks that you have appended to the letters respecting Mr. Morphy's proposed match with Mr. Staunton, you have dealt satisfactorily with the whole matter. The letters may be considered under two heads, one of which does not refer to, the other is written upon, the actual subject. That a few lines should be devoted not to the merits of the case will not surprise your readers when they remember that, prejudice being created against or in favor of a particular chess player, questions are not viewed in their true light. Still less will they be surprised when I take this opportunity of doing justice to Anderson, who is indirectly alluded to in one of those letters. Your Cambridge correspondent ridicules the notion of any evasion of play on the part of Mr. Staunton. His virtue, even approaching a fault, has been the continual search after a match. He resought St. Amant after defeating him. He exposed himself to everyone for 8 years, and thus earned two characters, one that of the chivalrous paladin, the other that of the representative of English chess. I wonder that any intelligent writer, such as your correspondent is, should not have traced the distinctions between resuming play against antagonists already beaten, or likely to be beaten, and commencing matches with really powerful combatants. I wonder, also, that he did not inform your readers that at the time at which St. Amant played with Mr. Staunton, the former, excellent as he was, received odds from Deschapelles, who was out of play. I wonder that, as if with perfect knowledge, he could write upon such a chess match without alluding to Deschapelles' celebrated criticism on the Staunton-St. Amant games, a criticism which, published in the Berliner Schatzzeitung of 1848, puts both players in their true places. I wonder, again, that he should not have summed up Mr. S.'s subsequent victories in two contests, one with Horwitz, the other with Harwitz. I wonder that he should not have told us that Horwitz publicly announced his inferiority to Derlasa and Hanstein, and that Harwitz, at the time mentioned, received P and two moves, but in the same year defeated Horwitz, the very player upon whose defeat, on even terms, Mr. S.'s reputation mainly depended after his match with St. Amant. Another instance of Mr. Staunton's chivalry is, says your correspondent, an offer to play any player in the world and to pay his expenses for coming to England. The best answer to this is to quote the actual conditions of the challenge propounded by Mr. G. Steffen on Mr. S.'s behalf in 1853. 1. If the acceptor of the challenge be resident abroad, the stake on each side shall be not less than £250. 2. If the challenge is taken up by a player resident in this country, the amount of the stake shall be from £100 to £150. 3. That the match be played at a private hotel, etc. After the proposal, Mr. Staunton gave it meaning in a public speech, Chess Players Chronicle, 1853. The challenge was intended for Anderson's acceptance. The £250 was to cover traveling expenses in a foreign country. Now I wish to ask your correspondent, is there here any offer to pay a competitor's expenses? Or will he read it as others do? I name £100 for men whom I do not fear, but £250 for Anderson, whom, as he beat me in 1851, I wish to play with. Nominally, the larger sum will cover his expenses, but as I intend to win, he will practically have to find £250, his expenses, and the bill at a private hotel, simply to give me, the chivalrous Bayard, my revenge. After this, I trust that we shall not hear of chivalry in offering to pay the expenses of a competitor. M.A., as a Cambridge man, may be asked whether Mr. S.'s engagement on a work of great magnitude, I quote his own words, is equal to Anderson's mathematical and philological labors. But Mr. S. is the representative of English chess. By whose election is he divine particula aure? Deschapelles was then irreverent, and I am an iconoclast. Is he self-elected? Then away with parliaments and associations of chess, and their self-elected speaker, fair play. I never yet heard of a man calling himself the representative of anything English, if he will not carry out his representation. I have heard of champions of the river retiring. I have seen them row and take a beating manfully. I know that Lewis, Fraser, Soles, Walker, etc., gave up difficult chess. I never yet heard of half and half play. Either a man pretends to represent English chess, or he does not. If he makes his claim, whether self-elected or not, he must play. A representative, however ignorant, gives his vote in the House of Commons. If not, he may retire into private life. Morphy may reply to your correspondent and to his coryphaeus at the same time, I have played for 10 years. I am not 21, but I am prepared to play the best European masters now. If I am challenged when I have taken up another pursuit, I will not do one thing. I will not accept a challenge, and months after not carry out my acceptance. I will not, after long delay, name even the day for commencing the match, and then have no idea of playing. True it is that you may not fairly represent English chess. Two British players separated Anderson from you in 1851, but, Williams being dead, Mr. Wyville not playing matches, and you still claiming priority in Anglo-Saxon chess, I, an Anglo-Saxon, on behalf of the race that speaks the same language as you, ask you, will you maintain or resign your claim? This is true reasoning. The contest, M.A. assures us, would be unequal. Mr. S. is P and two moves below his strength, yet he represents English play. Where, then, are the even players? Where the P and move men? Is the fragrance of the P and two moves so refreshing that the P and move must not be classed amongst our British roses? De Chapelle tells us that Philidor classed Legal as a player on even terms, Verdoni as one to receive pawn for the move, Bernard, Carlier, etc., as P and move players. I think better of English chess players than to claim, with M.A., our representative in a P and two moves player. Your Cambridge correspondent will pardon me for attempting to refute his positions. From the style of his letter, I am convinced that, had he equal experience, he would write much the same as I have done. Fair Play's letter may soon be dismissed. His argument is that Mr. Morphy came to Europe not to play Mr. Staunton, who had previously refused, F.P. should have added, to play in America, not in England, but to take part in the tournament held by the Chess Association at Birmingham, that he did not play there, sending different answers for his non-appearance, and, assuming this to be a fault, that therefore anyone may commit the same fault, if he can give better reasons for the commission. In answer to this, Mr. Morphy does not come to Europe to play at Birmingham, but to test his strength with the cis-Atlantic players. It reads almost like a joke when a man writes seriously from Birmingham to inform us that Morphy came 6,000 miles to play the first two or three games, especially when everyone in London has known for more than 3 months that he came to play long set matches. What was Mr. M.'s behavior? He came to England in June and visited Birmingham directly. He had been offered £70 as a retaining fee on account of the distance travelled by him. Similarly, Anderson, Staunton, etc., received retaining fees in 1857, but refused the offer, making, with characteristic generosity, such excuses as he had not received the Birmingham letters, and that the meeting was adjourned for 2 months. In other words, Mr. Morphy, giving up all pecuniary claim, practically paid nearly 7/8 of the prizes offered to public competition. Hence he did not take part in the little contest at Birmingham. He civilly assented to the alteration of time. He civilly left Lowenthal, whom he had beaten in a set match, a chance of gaining the first prize. He civilly gave answers to telegraphic messages, answers, I regret here that they were more polite than exact, that meant the same thing. I leave the contest to others. If these replies did not, as short telegraphic messages cannot, express Mr. M.'s meaning, it does not become those who profited by his chivalry to write in the style of Fair Play. And I am sure that the Birmingham local committee would be the first to gainsay the latter statement. He must be satisfied, at all events, as Lowenthal, just beaten by Morphy, met Mr. Staunton, whom he was anxious to see pitted against the young American, and won, thereby saving criticism as to what was, might be, or could be. What will be, we shall see. Mr. M. went to Birmingham simply to get Mr. S. to name, in the presence of others, a day for commencing the proposed match. Then and there Mr. S. named the 1st of November. A representative of Englishmen should either give a bona fide acceptance or a refusal. Murphy's motto is, play, not talk. He comes and goes to foreign countries to seek play. He is the Il Puttino of the New World. At the risk, then, sir, of being called a frivolous noodle by your very elegant correspondent, Fair Play, I shall take the liberty of believing what an honest man like Morphy says. I shall not hold Staunton to be the representative of English chess, but shall look to younger and more consistent players, as far more likely to maintain what your correspondents call the national honor, and am, sir, your obedient servant, an English chess player. East Sheen, October 21, 1858. The next two letters, also to the editor of Bell's Life in London, do not profess to argue the question, but are merely argumenta ad hominem. They serve to show how warm a feeling in his favor Mr. Morphy has evoked amongst the fellow countrymen of Mr. Staunton. To the editor of Bell's Life. Mr. Editor, the general opinion of English chess players is simply that Staunton is afraid of Morphy. If, as his friends say, he is out of condition, let him train, or give up the championship like a man. No one would blame him, at his age and with his avocation, for declining severe matches. But in that case he must resign the belt into fresher hands. The champion ceases to be the champion when he is no longer able or willing to take up whatever gauntlet is flung down. Let the chivalrous boy who has crossed the Atlantic to challenge the chess of the old world have fair play at the hands of Englishmen. If we cannot beat him fairly, let us not seek to put him off with shabby dodges. Yours, etc., ex-president of Provincial Chess Club, October 20th. This is sound, straightforward English common sense. To the editor of Bell's Life. Mr. Editor, Mr. Staunton either is or is not the chess champion of England, ready to defend his belt against all comers. If he be the champion, he has no right to plead want of practice, literary avocations, or such like excuses, for semper paratus must be a champion's motto. If he be not the champion, why then did he hold himself out as such by inviting or accepting Mr. Morphy's challenge? Why did he not say at the first, I was the champion of England some years ago, but, solve senescentem, I am not so now. I am only a private gentleman, engaged in literary pursuits, and so forth. His true position would then have been clearly understood. I am sure Mr. Morphy would never have sought to disturb his retirement. But will the English chess-playing public allow Mr. Staunton to put on this plea, after all that has passed, and after all his declarations of willingness to play? I trust, sir, that if such an excuse be allowed, at least we shall have the candor to acknowledge ourselves fairly vanquished, and not pretend that we have escaped defeat because we have prudently declined the contest. We must be on our guard for the future how we proclaim as our champion a gentleman who retires into private life the moment a formidable rival appears. Yours, etc., Shack. The week following the publication of the above letters, Mr. Staunton published in the Illustrated London News part of Mr. Morphy's communication, with the private answer sent a fortnight before. The paragraph in the former, relating to Mr. S.'s iniquitous statement of Morphy's arriving in Europe without funds, was entirely ignored, and that, too, in the face of its having been given in extenso 2 weeks previously by 4 weekly London papers, and a copy sent to his editor-in-chief. Quos Deus vult perdere, prius dementat, was never more thoroughly exemplified, and the course pursued proves incontestably that Mr. Staunton possessed a certain kind of courage which does not stick at trifles. Was it presumable that a man of his experience would dare to commit such an unwarrantable act, or did he think that Mr. Morphy would pass over, in silence, such a suppression? The animus was now evident. Mr. Staunton had never awarded that praise to the young American's contests which every other chess editor and player in England and Europe had invariably bestowed. Still, no action could be taken on this. Mr. Staunton had continually postponed the commencement of the match. No handle to take hold of was offered here, since he had, as continuously, asserted his desire to play. Mr. Staunton had announced that the stakes were reduced from £1,000 aside to £500 at Mr. Morphy's request. His antagonist was still silent. Mr. Staunton had published a knowingly untrue statement, and, when the sufferer complains in such a manner as to afford him the utmost latitude for explanation and apology, he cancels the paragraph and does not even deign to refer to it in his reply. Mr. Staunton caps the climax by declining finally to play the match. Thus Mr. Staunton's response to the New Orleans Chess Club, so far as he was concerned, meant nothing. His acceptance of Morphy's challenge in London, and the statement in his paper that the match would come off, meant nothing. His postponements meant nothing. His declarations before Lord Lyttelton and other gentlemen at Birmingham meant nothing. Thus there was apparently an end to the whole matter. But an eventuality presented itself. Mr. Staunton had showed himself capable of perverting facts to his own benefit, and might he not assert ultimately that Mr. Morphy was the cause of the match not taking place? Could he not, too, at the moment our hero was quitting Europe, declare his readiness to play, knowing that Morphy must be off? He had so acted towards Herr Anderssen, after the tournament in 1851, declaring that the German saw fit to leave, although he was well aware that the professor's collegiate duties at Breslau rendered it impossible for him to stay in England and play the proposed match. Paul Morphy therefore closed up every avenue of eventual misrepresentation by the following address to Lord Lyttelton in his official quality of President of the National Association of English Chess Players. Morphy's appeal to the British Chess Association. To the Right Honourable Lord Lyttelton, President of the British Chess Association. My Lord, on the 4th of last February the Chess Club of New Orleans gave a challenge to your countryman, Mr. Howard Staunton, to visit that city and engage in a match at chess with me. On the 3rd of April Mr. Staunton replied to this défi in the Illustrated London News, characterizing the terms of the cartel as being distinguished by extreme courtesy, but objecting to so long a journey for such a purpose, and engaging me to anticipate by a few months an intended voyage to Europe. Believing that a journey of many thousand miles was the only obstacle in the way of our meeting, I made immediate preparation, and within 2 months I had the pleasure of repeating the challenge personally in the rooms of the St. George's Chess Club. I need scarcely assure you, my lord, that Mr. Staunton enjoys a reputation in the United States unsurpassed by that of any player in Europe since the death of Labourdonnais, and I felt highly honored when he accepted my challenge, merely requesting a lapse of 1 month for the purpose of preparing himself for the encounter. Within a short period subsequently, Mr. Staunton obtained my consent to a postponement until after the annual meeting of the British Chess Association. A week prior to that event, I addressed him in the following terms. Dear Sir, as we are now approaching the Birmingham meeting, at the termination of which you have fixed our match to commence, I think it would be advisable to settle the preliminaries during this week. Would you be good enough to state some early period when your seconds can meet mine, so that a contest which I have so much at heart, and from which your eminent position excites so much interest in the chess world, may be looked upon as a fait accompli? I am, dear sir, yours very respectfully, Paul Morphy. Not receiving a satisfactory reply to this communication, I again wrote Mr. Staunton as follows. Dear Sir, I must first apologize for not replying to your previous communication. As you observe, my numerous contests must be the excuse for my remissness. It is certainly a high compliment to so young a player as myself that you, whose reputation in the chess arena has been unapproached during so many long years, should require any preparation for our match. Immediately on my arrival in England, some 2 months since, I spoke to you in reference to our contest, and, in accepting the challenge, you stated that you should require some time to prepare, and you proposed a period for commencing, which I accepted. I am well aware that your many engagements in the literary world must put you to some inconvenience in meeting me, and I am therefore desirous to consult your wishes in every respect. Would you please state the earliest opportunity when those engagements will permit the match coming off, such time being consistent with your previous preparation? The few weeks referred to in your favor seem to be rather vague, and I shall feel highly gratified by your fixing a definite period for the contest. I leave the terms entirely to yourself. I remain, dear sir, yours very respectfully, Paul Morphy. Mr. Staunton left London for Birmingham without deigning to reply. I attended the annual meeting of the association for the express purpose of requesting a definite period for commencing the match. In the presence of your lordship and other gentlemen, Mr. Staunton fixed that commencement for the fore part of November, promising that he would inform me of the precise date within a few days. I heard nothing further from him on the subject. Your lordship will have remembered from the above that Mr. Staunton has thus obtained 3 separate and distinct postponements. The approach of November induced me again to address Mr. Staunton, which I did on the 6th of the present month. As my letter was published in numerous London journals, and was also sent to the editor-in-chief of the Illustrated London News, I had a right to expect a public answer, particularly as I had complained of a false and damaging statement in the chess department of that paper. On the 16th, Mr. Staunton stated editorially that Mr. Morphy's games this week exclude both his letter and Mr. Staunton's reply. If we can spare space for them, they shall be given in the next number. On the 9th instant, within a short time of receiving my letter, Mr. Staunton replied to me privately, As my communication was a public one, I was somewhat surprised at the course pursued by a gentleman holding such a position as Mr. Staunton, and did not therefore even acknowledge receipt, fearing that I might thereby be induced unintentionally to commit myself. Having promised my letter and his reply, Mr. Staunton published what he represents as such in the Illustrated London News of the 23rd instant. He has thereby transferred the question from the chess arena to the bar of public opinion, and as a stranger in a foreign land, a land which has ever been the foremost in hospitality, I claim justice from Englishmen. The most important portion of my letter Mr. Staunton has dared to suppress. I refer to the following paragraph, published by various journals but omitted by the Illustrated London News, although sent to the editor of that paper as well as to Mr. Staunton himself. A statement appeared in the chess department of that journal a few weeks since that Mr. Morphy had come to Europe unprovided with backers or seconds, the inference being obvious, that my want of funds was the reason of our match not taking place. As you are the editor of that department of the Illustrated London News, I felt hurt that a gentleman who had always received me at his club and elsewhere with great kindness and courtesy should allow so prejudicial a statement to be made in reference to me, one, too, which is not strictly in accordance with fact. On my first arriving in England, I informed Mr. Staunton that my stakes would be forthcoming the moment he desired, and I was therefore utterly at a loss to account for so unwarrantable a statement being made in reference to me, unless with the intention of compromising my position before the public. And I would ask your lordship's attention to the terms of the suppressed paragraph, couched in such language as to avoid all insinuation of animus, and affording Mr. Staunton the amplest opportunity for explaining away the difficulty. The course pursued by that gentleman cannot do otherwise than justify me in ascribing to him the very worst of motives in publishing what he knew to be incorrect, in denying me common justice, and in giving as the whole of my letter what he knew to be only a part of it. From Mr. Staunton I now appeal to the great body of English chess players. I appeal to the British Chess Association. I appeal to yourself, my lord, as Maecenas of English chess. And, as I visited your country for the purpose of challenging Mr. Staunton, which challenge he has repeatedly accepted, I now demand of you that you shall declare to the world it is through no fault of mine that this match has not taken place. I have the honor to remain, my lord, yours very respectfully, Paul Morphy. Café de la Régence, Paris, October 26, 1858. End of section 10.
Tune in next week for another installment of a Radio Lillooet special presentation of the exploits and triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, chess champion. A book by Frederick Milnes Edge in five parts.